Bad Quaker.com podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Tuesday, December 11th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 244. Now, before I get going today in the podcast, I have a huge announcement. Taryn Lupo, the author and sponsor of the podcast here, is offering free for 24 hours the Kindle versions of One Nation Under Blood, Savannah's Scariest Short Stories, and Pirates of Savannah. They're all free today. Taryn is also giving away some other freebies, too. So what do? You get over to badquaker.com, look in today's show notes, and follow the link. If you use that link, then you can get over to Amazon and get those books for free and some of the other stuff that Taryn's offering for free. Now, again, this is only for 24 hours. So, and you have to follow that link at badquaker.com. So get to badquaker.com, look for the link that says free for 24 hours, Taryn Lupo books, and hit that. And these are the Kindle versions. So, you know, get over there, get that for free. I mean, why not, you know? And also this will help, Taryn also, because it'll, you know, it'll boost his sales and get the stories out there. He's a really good author and I really enjoy reading his stuff. So that will get, you know, more and more attention. And tell other people, too. Tell anybody that you can to get over to badquaker.com, use that link, and get over there and get some free stuff from Taryn. This is really nice of him to do a promotional thing like that. Okay, now, so today's podcast was partially, well, maybe more than partially inspired by a Facebook incident that recently happened. There's this guy, Justin Amish, who's, you know, some kind of tax eater, I don't know, whatever. And he had made a lot of, you know, a lot of libertarian people are really, they really like him. They really think he's the bee's knees. But, you know, he's just another tax eater. And so he says a couple things that kind of sound a little bit libertarian. And maybe he shows up at a Tea Party rally and, you know, he talks all the right talk and everything. So libertarians get all giddy whenever they, you know, hear anything about Justin Amish or Amish or however he says his name. So so then the other day, he made the statement that literally anything was on the table when it comes to balancing the budget. And he, specifically, that means, you know, tax increases. He's comfortable with a tax increase if it'll balance the budget. So in other words, you know, the idea that that maybe stealing more from you to pay for more government programs is a good idea. Somehow that's justified, and somehow libertarians, you know, just clap with glee over that. Isn't that wonderful? He wants to rob us some more. Now, of course, that's not his primary, you know, agenda. Of course, he talks like all the other politicians talk, especially in the, you know, towards the right side of the category. They always talk about wanting to cut government and cut taxes and cut spending and cut, but their version of cut is just increasing less. You know, that's what they call a cut. But when they want to increase something, it's an actual increase. So, you know, so he made this statement, and then I linked in Facebook to a site where someone called him out on it. And I made the statement, you know, that I just don't understand, really, why libertarians, and I put that in quotes, why libertarians get all fuzzy and warm and feel really good about guys like this Amish and this, like Rand Paul. You know, Rand Paul will just say some hideous things sometimes. Or, you know, he's already planning a trip to Israel right before the 2016 presidential race. How convenient. Won't that be a good idea to go to Israel on the dime of the Israel lobbyists? Go to Israel, being paid for completely by the Israeli lobbyists, and you do that right before a presidential run. Isn't that cute? Nice way to go, Rand. So, you know, so these guys like Rand Paul and Justin Amash, you know, they're living off of the taxes of others. They're using all the libertarian words, and, you know, they'll refer to Ayn Rand, or they'll refer to something Hayek wrote, or maybe not even something he wrote, just to refer to Hayek in general, you know. And somehow that's a pass. They can do or say anything else, and it's all forgiven, you know. And in Facebook, I compared it to someone getting excited about a bomber style pleather jacket, you know, or a commemorative golden clad copy of a coin or something like this. You know how they do those commemorative coins that are worth nothing, but they give them a microscopic coating of gold, and then if you're not really careful how you read the wording, you think it's an actual gold coin that they're selling for, you know, $39.95 or whatever. Yeah, that's a really good deal there. Take one of those down to a coin dealer and see what he'll give you for it. You pay $40 for it, he might give you 20 cents if you can get him to buy it. Most of that stuff has absolutely no value at all if you take it to a coin dealer. So anyway, that's a sort of a side rant. But so I made this, you know, I compared Rand and this Justin Amash. I compared him to these, you know, fake coated coins and pleather jackets. And one of my Facebook friends made a comment that seemed, you know, reasonable. But somebody that was a friend with him saw his comment and then came over and saw the link and saw my statement, and just kind of went ballistic. And there, and I was off of Facebook at the time, but there was about a 5-hour fight, for lack of a better terminology. What do you call a Facebook fight? Anyway, so for like 5 hours, people went at it over this. And I came in 5 hours later, and I started reading down the thread. And I'm looking at this status that was attacking my friend on Facebook. And I'm reading his attacks, and it's all just piles and piles of straw man arguments, accusing him of all kinds of positions. And he's like, when did I ever say that? When did I ever say that? When did I ever say that? When did I ever support that position? And of course, that doesn't stop the guy. He just screams and piles more and more accusations that are all coming out of his own imagination, you know. And this is what these statists do, these so-called libertarians, these minarchists or minimum government or constitutionalists or, you know, whatever they want to label themselves. Ultimately, they are they're apologists for the state. Ultimately, when you engage them in conversation, what you find out is that deep down inside, they radically adhere to a religion, and that religion is the state. And if you say something that pricks their ears, something that causes them to have to reevaluate what it is they believe, what it is they stand on, you almost always get exaggerated levels of anger out of these people. And, you know, logic goes right out the window. And all they want to do is, layers and layers of vulgarity dumps out of them. And one time I was in a conversation on Facebook, and the person that I was talking to started throwing layers and layers of vulgarities at me, and no argument, just vulgarities. And so I said back to that person, you know, your vulgarities are not going to convince me. You can't say naughty words at me and me suddenly go, oh, wow, you're right. I need to go vote. I mean, you know, who believes that's even useful? But because I said your vulgarities are not going to convince me of your position, he attacked me then further by saying that I was some kind of Puritan that was offended at other people's language. I don't care what language you use. You say anything you want. Your words can't harm me in any way. You say any particular word you want to say, and it means nothing to me. But it's not going to convince me of anything either. Calling me names or using vulgarities is not going to convince me of anything. And I don't really understand the mentality when people do that. So, you know, and the funny part in that situation was when he attacked me back, because I had said your vulgarities won't convince me of anything. So his counterattack back to me was that I wasn't a very good anarchist because I don't use vulgarities. Except he didn't say vulgarities. He said profanity. Because I don't use profanity, I'm not a good anarchist. And I thought that's funny because, you know, I'm kind of a word Nazi myself, as longtime listeners have probably noticed. So when somebody says the word vulgarity, of course, vulgarity, that word has a meaning. It's vulgar. It's something that attacks, you know, your sense of your senses. So if we're talking about using slang to refer to human excrement, of course, that's a vulgarity. But a profanity is different. A profanity is specifically attacking your belief, your belief system, or your religion, or something along that line. So, actually, everything that I say, in a very real sense, is a profanity. Everything that I say on these podcasts, because the whole purpose of this podcast is to show that there is a religion, a very evil religion that's dominant in the world right now, and it's called the state. Belief in this magical being, the state, grips the mind of people all over the world, and it causes them to act in the most evil and hideous ways. So everything that I'm saying is, by its very definition, a profanity. When I tell you that voting is an act of aggression, that is a profanity. I am spewing profanities when I tell you that any time you use the government to accomplish the means that you want to accomplish, you're using aggression. See, that's a profanity. I'm using profanities right now. But if I used words that I can't say over the radio, would that make you believe them? Well, that's the notion's silly, isn't it? So, you know, so I spent years and years in a professional setting where the use of vulgarities was frowned upon. And so my particular modes of speech generally, not always, but generally do not utilize vulgarities. Now, that's not to say that I never use vulgarities. If vulgarities spew out of my mouth on an endless basis, then they have no real meaning, do they? I mean, it's kind of like if you're talking to someone and they use the word like, three or four times in every sentence, like, you know, then pretty soon that word has no meaning whatsoever. And vulgarities are the same way. If every time you open your mouth, vulgarities start spewing out of it, then they really have no meaning. It's just like saying like constantly, or saying y'all constantly, or any other unnecessary aspect of speech. So, on the other hand, if I'm in a really important situation where a person's actions are about to cause me to take actions that might be of a permanent nature. Am I saying that vague enough? All right, let me say it a little bit clearer. Let's imagine a scenario. Let's say I'm at a restaurant, and someone accidentally bumps into me at the table behind me or whatever. No big deal, right? But let's say in that exchange, the other person wants to get tough and maybe make some kind of veiled threat with me. Well, if that was to happen at that particular moment, I would get very close to that person's face, and I would let them know in no uncertain terms that they do not want to pursue this topic. And at a moment like that, I might use a vulgarity, and I might use it with the kind of power and authority that will cause that person to reevaluate their course of action. You see, because the vulgarity has power when used like that. But when you're in the middle of a conversation and you're trying to convince somebody of, you know, whether or not it's a good idea to vote, or whether or not Justin Amash is a good politician or a bad politician, like that's even a possibility of being a good politician. If you're in that situation and it's your goal to, you know, to convince someone of something, then your vulgarities mean nothing. It's a complete waste of, you know, as far as typing on the internet, it's a waste of energy to type those things. You're not going to convince anybody by calling them names or by accusing them of things. And it's silly to think of that. But yet these statists very often fall into that trap. And And why? Well, partially because of the frustration of not really being secure in really in their beliefs. These deep insecurities just drive the unbridled anger that you see coming out of them in situations like this. So, you know, to end the story with a Facebook incident that just happened. So I posted this thing about Justin Amash and Rand Paul, and a five-hour argument ensued. And then I stepped back in, and I read through the arguments, and I made just the brief statement, you know, it's really funny. This guy is so informed. All he does is pile up straw man arguments, and that's it. That's all he can do is pile up straw man arguments. And so this person, of course, I tagged him in my comment because I don't talk behind people's back. I make my arguments out in the public, as you hear right at this moment. So the guy then, he responded by, I believe he attempted to turn me into Facebook. And I know that he did block me. But at the same time, he sent me a personal message in Facebook that was just packed full of vulgarities and accusations and, you know, you're stupid because you're stupid, that kind of logic. And, of course, he blocked me at the same time, so I couldn't even respond to his message. But when he blocked me, he also blocked his access to see the posts that he had been posting on. The thread that he had been posting on. So he actually blocked himself off of the thread that he had been posting on. And then he's unbelievably mad at me because he thought I deleted it. Well, I didn't delete it. It's all right there. And then so now that he's abandoned the thread, essentially, by trying to block me and block the other people that were on the thread, and he's unbelievably angry, so he's sending messages to other people in Facebook. They're trying to explain to him it's his own actions that caused this, and he's getting mad and blocking them as well. And it's just hilarious to watch somebody who, you know, you're just popping the bubble that all their faith, all their beliefs are based in. You're just shattering their hopes when you say something that causes them to think like that. It causes them to have to reevaluate the things the foundational faith that they have in the state. And when a person does that, you know, you can react in a couple different ways. When faced with the realities of the myth of the state, there's a couple different ways that are very commonly seen. And the anger reaction is, you know, probably the most common. Far less common is the deep, thoughtful, like, really? And we saw that very vividly at Porkfest. We put out a sign at the motorhome there in Porkfest that said free food and argument. And we were giving away like free hot dogs and free nachos and free chili and stuff like this. And then, you know, people would come and sit with us and eat, and we would discuss things. And this one guy was really, really drunk, but really nice. But he was just plastered, and he wanted to have an argument and free food. Mostly he wanted an argument. So he sat with us, and we all talked very peaceably. And every time that he had a question, because unfortunately for him, he was horribly outnumbered. There was probably 8 or 10 of us there that were on our side of the argument, and he alone was on his side. But he, again, everything was very polite, and it was a very controlled discussion. And as he would bring out a question or a concern, and then we would completely, thoroughly cover it in a very polite way, and his response would always be, really? I'll have to think about that. And then he'd think a little bit, and then he'd bring out another question. And he actually came back to the camp, if I recall, either 3 or 4 times that he came back to the camp. And each time, he was curious, and he was interested, but he was not angry and he was not violent. And you contrast that to so many other people who have so much emotion and so much of themselves invested in believing that the state is a good thing and that state can be used and that, you know, government, the aggression of government can be used to accomplish their means. You know, and they go and they vote and they put signs in the yard. I used to do all that stuff too. I'm not perfect, but as my eyes began to open and as I began to see these things differently, And as I began to use the zero aggression policy, the zero aggression principle, to analyze each thing and say, is this aggression or is this not aggression? What is the root here? What is accomplished through these activities? And as I began to analyze each and every aspect, I came to the conclusions that I've come to now. But I wasn't always, I'm not condemning anybody for being a statist, because I wasn't always a statist. I had to come to these conclusions very gradually. But once you get there, you're not going to back up. You're not going to go back and say, yeah, I want to support the government. I want to use the government to accomplish what I want. You're just not going to do it. And someone screaming, you know, vulgarities at you is certainly not going to convince you that aggression is good. Okay, stick with me. I'll be right back. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge. Real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. All the courses, plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. Now, as I was watching this happen on Facebook, and actually the same thing when I've watched it happen before on Facebook, I'm often reminded of an article that Murray Rothbard did way back in the 70s. It's titled, Do You Hate the State? And Murray contributed to the Libertarian Forum. You can find it in Volume 10, Number 7 from July 1977 if you have a pile of those laying around. If you're like most normal humans and you don't have a pile of old Libertarian Forum magazines laying around from July 1977, there's several ways that you can find this article. I'll put a link in today's show notes for two different sources. One is over at the Mises Institute, and the other source that I'll put a link to is actually Bad Quaker. I did an article, it's been about a year ago, that I used Murray Rothbard's article, and I just switched the names around. And let me put it this way. The article itself, Do You Hate the State, is essentially Murray taking on David Friedman, and taking on some of David Friedman's positions and his position that he takes in his book, and comparing it to Murray's position and positions Murray has taken at different times. And so the conclusion that Rothbard comes to in this article is that, yes, David Friedman is an anarcho-capitalist, much like Murray Rothbard, and he's a very smart man, and, you know, all the good things like that, everything polite, except deep down in his belly, deep inside, David Friedman does not hate the state. He sees the state as being a slightly less form of government than self-government would be. That self-government, you know, anarchism, anarcho-capitalism, self-government would be preferable to the state, but the state's really not so bad. Government, as it functions today, may not be perfect, but it's okay. And Murray's position is quite the opposite of that. Murray takes the position, of course, that the government is nothing but a gang of thieves that live off the rest of society. They do not provide services. The justice, so-called justice that they provide, is twisted and perverted and not actual justice. No service that the government provides is worth the cost of having government. This is Murray Rothbard's position. And there are nuances, too, as to the difference between Rothbard and Friedman. But essentially, it all boils, and this is the point of Murray's argument, essentially, it all boils down to how you look at this myth of the state. Is it something that is truly evil, or is it just an inconvenience that we have to learn to tolerate? And this is the difference. And so in this article, Murray calls David Friedman out by name and goes through all this. And he actually also talks about David Friedman's father, Milton Friedman. And so I'm always reminded of this article whenever I see something like what happened on Facebook, that, you know, really there are people who have they take on the mantle, or they take on the title, or however you want to put it. They call themselves libertarian, or they call themselves anarcho-capitalist. But deep down inside, they're really comfortable with the existence of government. And now David Friedman put up a defense of this, and he wrote a fairly short article defending himself against Murray's accusations. And so the way David Friedman defended himself was by agreeing with Murray. He agreed to the main point of Murray's article. He basically said, yeah, this is true. This is exactly true. I think we should be able to work with government and try to make it as comfortable and, you know, as possible, and try to reduce it slowly and do this gradualism and so forth that David Friedman supports. So basically, on the main point of the argument, he agreed with Murray, and then to finish it off, he made two personal attacks on Murray Rothbard. And I thought, And these attacks were entirely off topic, and they serve no purpose to the libertarian cause of whether or not, you know, it was correct to really have this hatred of the state, or if we should accept the state. They were completely off topic to that. They were just, you know, unnecessary personal attacks on Murray Rothbard. And I thought, now look at this. Here's an anarchist who points out the folly of a minarchist, and the minarchist responding with a personal attack. Shocking, isn't it? We never see that, do we? Or do we? We see it all the time, every time, almost every time. The so-called libertarian can't logically defend their position, so they revert to personal attacks. But now I do want to say this in praise of Friedman, or perhaps in defense of Friedman. At least he's honest. Most of these people, most of these minarchists, are not as honest as David Friedman. Most of them refuse to actually face the fact that they love the state, they embrace the state, they wish to use government as long as it's the way they want. Most of them lie to themselves. And, you know, conservatives and liberals are even worse about lying to themselves about this. But the people who call themselves minarchists or libertarians, or even some people who call themselves anarchists, but they still want to use the state, they still want to use the mechanisms of the state and the aggression of government, they're really just lying to themselves. So to see David Friedman be honest like that is really refreshing, that he is an honest man, and that he does admits this freely, that this is the difference between he and Rothbard. That's a lot better than most of them. And in case you didn't know, I'm sure you probably do know this, but David Friedman is the son of economist Milton Friedman, and David Friedman is the father of Patry Friedman. I believe that's how you pronounce his name, Patry. Anyway, these are two pretty famous people. Milton Friedman, well, let's go at it this way. I can see a sort of progression within this Friedman family, from Milton to David to Petrie. And it's a refreshing progression, because a lot of people say Milton Friedman was a libertarian, and there's a lot of, you know, he called himself that at times, and there's a lot of the terminology that's used. But if you look at the things that Milton Friedman pushed, and then what David Friedman says today, and then the direction that Patry Friedman is going now, you can see this progression, and it's in a very positive direction, that is. So I have to wonder how many generations until the the Freedmans actually get it right, you know? Think of Milton Freeman for a second. Now, again, we're told that he's gone now, but we're told he was a libertarian, right? But his most famous idea, the thing that really got him notoriety, and the thing that probably won the Nobel Prize for him, was the payroll deduction of income taxes, the so-called withholding tax. That was Milton Freeman's idea. He presented that to government, and they grabbed it right up. You see, this is how you take half or up to two-thirds of people's income without them realizing it. You just slowly take it out of their paycheck before they ever see it. You see? Brilliant. What a great way to steal. If you can steal from somebody before they realize they have the money, you've accomplished it. You've done it. You've created the perfect robbery. If you can steal from someone before they know that they have it, then that's the perfect robbery. And that was Milton Freeman's idea. Really libertarian of him, wasn't it? How about this one? He's really well known for this idea, the so-called negative income tax. It's really more of a national minimum wage on steroids. It's just pure socialism. They're going to steal, the government is going to steal from all of the hardworking people in America and give everybody a minimum income. Brilliant, right? How would an economist come to a conclusion like this? Well, here's how. Because ultimately, even though they call it the Chicago School of Economics, ultimately it's Keynesianism. Ultimately, it's ignoring praxeology. It's ignoring human behavior. Because what happens if you give everybody in the United States a minimum wage, a living wage that everybody gets, whether they work or not, whether they're disabled, whether they're healthy, whether they make $1 million a year? Well, he didn't go that far. But everybody in his scheme, everybody would get a certain income to live on. And if you didn't make enough money, then the government would give you more money. And if you made even less money, the government would give you more money. So if you work none at all, the government would still give you as much money as if you worked, but worked every day, but just didn't quite make enough money, then the government would pay you one way or the other, whether you worked or not. Well, of course, this would create a massive incentive not to work, wouldn't it? This would create an entire class of people who lived off the work of others. And that's libertarian? That's socialism. That's pure socialism. Under a system like that, who'd be stupid enough to work? I mean, really? If the government's going to pay everybody, whether you work or not, you're going to get paid, and you're going to get paid enough to live, you know, comfortably. Why would you ever work? Why would anybody work? Now, Milton Freeman's other big idea was school vouchers. And this sounds, this just makes people get all warm and fuzzy inside. The government's stealing from us. We ought to be able to get some of that money back, and then we can choose where our kids go to school, right? Sounds great, doesn't it? Well, that's kind of, you know, if you'd never read Bastiat, you might think that something, a scheme like that could work. But the problem is, once you get a situation where private schools are dependent upon government money, then they're not private schools anymore, really, are they? If you have a situation even where homeschooling is getting government money to homeschool, well, of course, someone in government is going to have to check on you to make sure that this is not that you're not ripping off the government. They're going to need to inspect and make sure you really have children there, that you're really teaching them. What are you doing? You're inviting the government into your homeschool. Is that a good idea? Because ultimately, that's where it has to lead to. Ultimately, it has to lead to government inspectors coming into private schools and going through the books and going through all the testing and authorizing everything that's taught. That's where school voucher programs will have to lead if you just follow through the basic steps. That has to be the conclusion. So again, we're talking about massive government intervention and huge bureaucracies created to handle all this stuff. Really libertarian, isn't it? All right, well, how about Milton Freeman's other big thing that he supported? Fiat paper money. That was him. Yeah. He wasn't real happy with the Federal Reserve, but he said as long as it exists, we ought to use it. We ought to use it to do what? To have a constant rate of inflation. so that the government could pay for itself. He wants to pay for government expansion through consistent inflation of the money supply, through constantly devaluing the dollar he pays for government. It's an invisible tax. It's kind of like that withholding tax that he invented. You see, if you can make people comfortable with the way you rob them, then they're not going to object. Keep in mind, Milton Friedman was Ronald Reagan's economic advisor. And you can learn a lot from that little statement, because Ronald Reagan, much like Milton Friedman, used all the libertarian words. He sounded great. He sounded very libertarian. He talked about how government was the problem, not the answer, and he had all those great libertarian phrases that he said. But at the end of the day, what did he do? He expanded government tremendously, made, you know, government was much bigger at the end of Reagan's era than before it. Taxes were higher. He raised taxes 11 times. Very libertarian, right? Sure, it felt, if you just listen to the words, it felt like Reagan was doing great. But what was happening behind the scenes? What was the government really doing? Well, the neocons became entrenched because of that. And because a guy spouted libertarianism, got elected, and then failed to follow through on it, the libertarian movement took a horrible hit. By 88, there was a very small handful of us left, because we had been discredited so bad by what Ronald Reagan had done. And Milton Friedman was right there in on it. He was part of the deal. He was an advisor to Reagan. So what did Milton Friedman really do? Well, he relabeled Keynesian economics as Chicago economics and made it more palatable. That's all he really did. Looking at the difference between Keynesian economics and Chicago economics is like looking at the difference between a New York pizza and a Chicago pizza. Either way, it's still pizza. It's just flavored bread. That's all it is. It's just a different flavor of bread to keep the slaves happy. All right, so, you know, this one's got more of this or this one's got more of that. But really, you're just getting fed more bread to keep the slaves happy. And that's what either Chicago economics or Keynesian economics is. They never go back and really examine praxeology and figure out why it is that humans behave the way they behave, and what can we do about it, and what can we do to not set up situations where humans are going to respond to stimulus and behave badly. And again, the school vouchers and the negative income tax, which is basically a national minimum wage on steroids. These things, you don't, unless you think through the consequences of those actions. Unless you think through, well, how are people going to respond to this? Don't look at the simple answer. I want everybody to be happy and have lots of money, so we'll just give it to them. Well, don't think beyond that. That's like that cop in New York that everybody made such a big deal about. He's going to feel all warm and fuzzy by going in and buying $100 boots or $80 boots or whatever they were and giving them to the homeless guy. Well, it turns out the guy wasn't homeless. And what did he do with the boots? He got rid of them right away. Because what happens when a guy on the streets is walking around with $100 boots? He gets a knife in the ribs and his boots get stolen. Well, the bum was smarter than the cop. You want the guy killed? Is that cop? Is that what your intention was? You want the guy killed? He didn't know what time it is either. You want to give him a Rolex? Why don't you think about the consequences of your actions? Of course, if you thought about the consequences of your actions, you wouldn't be a cop, would you? Oh, no. Did Ben just say that? That one even got the dogs upset. Did Ben just say that? Yeah. If you think about the consequences of your actions, you won't be a cop. You'll find real work. You'll find legitimate work. You'll find some kind of respectful, peaceful work that doesn't aggress on other people. And if you're a cop and you're offended by that, well, let's go back and examine it. You want to talk about it like the guy in Facebook? We can talk about it like the guy in Facebook, or we can talk about it like the guy at Porkfest. We can be civil about it, and we can examine what are the consequences of your actions. When you do A and B and C results, is C what you want to happen? You see, when you're using the aggression of government, whether you're a cop or a politician or whatever, it doesn't matter. When you're using the aggression of government to accomplish what you want to accomplish, you are evil. You are behaving in an evil way. This is immoral. You are aggressing. That's what evil is. Evil is when a person aggresses upon another person. That's what evil is. And when a society accepts that which is evil and calls it good, then the society itself is doomed. But when those of us who can see this speak out, then other people who are on the edge, who are not quite sure one way or the other, if we can just open their eyes enough to just get them to see a little bit, then maybe we'll have a purpose here, and maybe we can actually accomplish something. But you have to ask yourself one way or the other. Are you gonna take this message like the guy at Porkfest and think about it? And just think about it. Let it sink in. Or are you going to respond with vulgarities and attacks? I'll be right back. Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial, and I want to give a reminder, considering that you just heard the commercial for Taryn Lupo's books, I want to give the reminder that if you follow the link at badquaker.com in today's show notes, for 24 hours, you can use that link to get free books from Taryn Lupo. And these are Kindle versions. And so get over to badquaker.com, hit that link, and get some free stuff from Taryn. Okay, so now you might be asking yourself, well, you know, what good does it really do to attack a dead guy? What good does it do to attack Milton Friedman? Well, I'm trying to show a certain progression here. You know, people have called Milton Friedman libertarian, and he took that title himself. And, you know, David, his son, if you can put it on a scale, is far more libertarian than his dad was. But yet, you know, he's still an apologist for the state. And that's essentially what he admitted to in his rebuttal to Rothbard. He admitted that Rothbard is correct, that he does not hate the state. He does not have that deep within him. So he doesn't recognize the state as being evil. He sees it as being, let's look at it this way. Let me read a section from Wikipedia on David Friedman. It says, in his book, The Machinery of Freedom, Friedman sketched a form of anarcho-capitalism where all goods and services, including law itself, can be produced by the free market. This differs from the version proposed by Murray Rothbard, where a legal code would first be consented to by the parties involved in setting up an anarcho-capitalist society. Friedman advocates an incrementalist approach to achieve anarcho-capitalism by a gradual privatization of areas that government is involved in, ultimately privatizing law and order itself. In the book, he states his opposition to violent anarcho-capitalist revolution. Violent anarcho-capitalist revolution. Who is for violent anarcho-capitalist revolution? I'm not sure. I'm not for violent revolution. I've said over and over, and I think pretty much everybody in the modern anarcho-capitalist movement is in the same boat in this. Revolution is only going to produce, is only going to make a stronger state. That's all it ever does. Armed revolution never works towards helping people become more free, towards liberty or towards freedom. You can't be more free. You're either free or you're not. But you understand my point. Revolution always backfires on the very people that initiate the revolution, and it ends up with just some other tax feeder in control of the violence of government. So revolution, no, revolution is not the answer, never has been the answer, never will be the answer. Revolution is counterproductive to the anarcho-capitalist purpose. So I don't know who he's, you know, who he's refuting there, but certainly I'd never heard Murray Rothbard say anything positive about a violent revolution. So I don't know who that's aimed at. But anyway, okay. So then, gradual privatization of what government does. That's what David Friedman calls for, gradual privatization. Well, yeah. So three cheers for Halliburton, Blackwater, and Corrections Corporation of America. There's three versions of privatizing what government does, you see? Or how about three cheers for Enron, Waste Management, and the Federal Reserve? Isn't that what those three companies do? Didn't Enron, Waste Management, and the Federal Reserve, aren't they basically just corporations that are now doing the function, well, not now because Enron is no longer around, but Waste Management, Federal Reserve, aren't those just corporations that are now doing what used to be done by the government or what is done by the government in other countries? Isn't that what we're talking about? This is fascism, folks. This is not libertarianism. Privatization plus blind faith in the state equals fascism. This is not good, folks. This is not what we should want. So what services do private companies offer? Other than the ones that I'm naming here, what services do private companies offer in place of government? Well, one way to look at that might be to say, well, who are the top government contractors? Who does the government pay to do its work for it? Who does the government steal your money and then take that money and give to corporations so those corporations can do the things that the government is too inept to do itself? So who are the top? Well, if we look at who the top five government contractors are. Now, this is really interesting. I looked this up just out of curiosity, and I'm going to read them from the number one government contractor to the number five. You ready for this? Lockheed Martin, number one. Boeing, number two. Northrop Grumman, number three. General Dynamics, number four. And Raytheon, number five. So what is it that government can't do itself and it has to contract out? Kill. Create machines that can kill with efficiency that government is incapable of. What? Soldiers marching on the ground don't kill with the efficiency you need? No problem. General Dynamics and Raytheon can fix that for you. We can have some pimply-faced nerd in Arizona can push a button and people can die. Half of a wedding party is dead. That's much more efficient than marching 10,000 troops across the desert, isn't it? So yeah, this is a really good idea, David. Let's just privatize, let's have private corporations just step in there and start taking over more and more aspects of the government. You imagine what would happen if a private corporation was to take on the responsibilities of the IRS. Holy moly. Great idea. Brilliant. Very libertarian, right? So really what both David and Milton Friedman, what they're really trying to do is make government more efficient and more acceptable to the governed, to the owned. They want to make it so government uses the money it steals from us in a more efficient way, and they want to make it so that we don't feel this quite as badly. Now, how do you say this politely? Is this like combating rape by giving out lubricants? Is that what this is like? I'm sorry if that's... Am I being too vulgar? Oh, wait, maybe I am being vulgar. But I think maybe there's times when a person can be vulgar. And I can't really imagine a better way to describe, this process than like that. All right, so now I'm done picking on David Friedman, and I'm done picking on Milton Friedman. And so that leaves me with Patry. Now, I've never met him, but I like a lot about what he's doing. He was the, Patry was the guy that made a fortune over at Google. Early on, when Google still used to be functional, and so Patry made some money at Google. That's really good. That's a really good thing to do. People should make money. I'm pro making money. Let me just state that publicly. I'm for people making money. And then Patrick did a really interesting thing. He started the, or he was one of the original people that started the Seasteading Institute. And I remember hearing his speech over at the Cato Institute when he very first announced all this. And I was thrilled by it. I thought, wow, this is really interesting. The idea, if you're unfamiliar with the Seasteading Institute, the idea was to get a bunch of libertarian people together and build floating cities that could compete with one another and compete with other governments. And so, you know, if the idea would be if you didn't like the particular floating city that you were a part of, you could just disconnect your sort of like a houseboat thing and go to another floating city. And this would create competition among these floating cities, and they would be, you know, more likely to be more libertarian oriented because of this. And of course, the idea that they would be like little floating Hong Kongs, and where there would be either zero or very, very low taxation, very low regulation, things like this. And I thought that's a really interesting idea. And so I've watched the seasteading people from a distance, but I was never really sold on the idea. I've always been fascinated by it since I first heard about it, but I was never really sold on the idea. Well, now it appears that Patry has jumped out of that, and he's in a group called Future Cities Development Corporation. Now, this is really confusing to me. They're one of the things that they're trying to do is buy a bunch of land down in Honduras and build sort of their own little Hong Kong down there. And it would be basically independent from Honduras, not be subjected to Honduras's laws and taxation and so forth. And this got some people really... Well, I'm confused about it, but some people are really excited and some people are very angry about it. I don't really know how that's going to end up. It does strike me as odd that this idea that you can centrally plan a stateless libertarian city, that just, I don't know, there's so many contradictory thoughts there. Of planning a centrally planned stateless libertarian city. It just doesn't make sense to me. But then again, establish a libertarian island city, you know, whether it be on the high seas, or at one point they talked about having it in the San Francisco Bay, or in the jungles of Honduras. You're going to face the exact same challenges as the folks in the Free State Project up in Wyoming, or the Free State Project in New Hampshire. You're going to face the exact same challenges and problems that they face, except all of Petrie's schemes seem to start out with spending billions of dollars just to get the project going, just to get it off its feet. It seems to me that the biggest expense, whether you're talking about having a floating island, you know, out a floating city out in the ocean, or whether you're talking about buying up a bunch of land in Honduras and trying to build some kind of centrally planned city of some kind, it seems to me like if you had all those billions of dollars, why not just move to New Hampshire? The land is going to be, you know, $1 billion would buy a lot of land in New Hampshire. What's the porcupine realtor's name? I can't remember his name, but I'm sure he'd be happy to steer Petrie towards some prime property in New Hampshire, and you've already got most of the infrastructure there. So if this idea is good, if this idea of moving out, you know, into a seasteading out onto an island, or if it's a good idea to move to Honduras and try to build a city, isn't it a better idea to move where there's already, you know, 85% of what you want is already there, and take the money that you would have spent on building these ships or on building a brand new city, cutting it out of the jungle and trying to establish it in some way? Rather than do that, why wouldn't you just go to Wyoming or go to New Hampshire and go into something that's already there? Yeah, it's 80% made. All you've got to do is, imagine the boost that the Free State Project would have if a billionaire stepped in and became part of it. But maybe deep down inside, I don't know. You know, I don't know what motivates Patry. I know what tends to be the pattern with super rich people when they have an idea like this. And that's generally speaking, and I'm not accusing Patry, because I don't know what's in his heart and in his soul, but generally speaking, a person who will want to centrally plan something like that usually wants to be in control, usually wants to have some level of being in control of the thing. So what are we really doing here? What are we really accomplishing? And I might add that, you know, Hong Kong is often used as an example of these, of some kind of libertarian goal. To have a place like Hong Kong where there's very few restrictions on business and where taxes are really low, and somehow libertarians often think that this is some kind of a libertarian paradise in Hong Kong. Well, if you believe that, go to Hong Kong and try to organize a peaceful protest. Try that in Hong Kong, and what you'll probably end up doing is wishing you had tried it in New York. Because as corrupt and mean and nasty as the cops are in New York, and as likely as you are to get your head busted by a cop in New York, you're far more likely to face a bigger problem with a cop in Hong Kong. Because when it comes to protest, when it comes to dissension in any kind of saying, hey, I don't like what's going on, I don't like being ruled by the state, you try that in Hong Kong, the cops there do not mess around. That's why you don't see Occupy Hong Kong protests, because they would get shut down really quickly. No, Hong Kong is not a libertarian paradise. Hong Kong is still a forced government. It's still a city state. Now they have some advantages in Hong Kong. I mentioned the lower taxes and less business regulations. They have 9 years of forced government indoctrination. Well, that's better than the U.S. The U.S. has 12 years of forced government indoctrination. So, yeah, it's like, Hong Kong compared to the U.S. is like picking cotton 9 hours a day instead of 12 hours a day. Well, I'm sure that I'm sure David Friedman would appreciate that. He seems to like to move more in that kind of a direction. But ultimately, Hong Kong is a city state, but it's still a state. You know, in the age of the corporate state, a city state may be preferable. It's stepping backward. It's sort of like this. It's sort of like that conservative myth of moving backwards to a constitutional republic. Remember that? Remember that myth that somehow if we could just move the government back to a constitutional republic, we'd be really happy? It doesn't matter that the constitutional republic brought us what we have today. We don't think about that. We just think, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we could go back? Well, sure. Anytime you can roll back the state, that's preferable. That's good. The problem is that's part of the myth. That's part of the myth of the state, that you can somehow roll it back to a tolerable level. And even if you could, that would be counterproductive. You see, the best way that we can ever, as a species, be free of the state is for people to understand just how hideous this horrible religion really is. And once people fully understand that Rothbardian idea, that the state is nothing but a gang of thieves living off of you and robbing you and dominating you and forcing you to behave the way it wants you to behave. When you see the state like that and you begin to develop a hatred for the state deep inside and an understanding that the state is nothing but an oppressive religion that supports a tiny priesthood that lives off of you, when you begin to understand that that's what the state is, then anything less than freedom is not acceptable. And once more and more people get that vision of the state, then the myth of the state begins to break down, and people start to understand that we only have this myth of the state because there's a market for it, because people want it. But as fewer and fewer people want it, at some point a tipping point will come, and people will not want the state anymore. And at that point in time, people will stop believing in the state. And like Stefan Molyneux has talked about, it's kind of like, you know, who believes in Zeus nowadays? Who believes in the old bull gods or the fish gods or the other gods of antiquity? Who believes in those today? And how did it happen that nobody does believe in those today? It happened because people stopped believing in those myths. And that's the same way with government. When people stop believing in the myth of the state, then the desire for aggressive government will cease. And people will naturally go back to what humans had prior to this, to the myth of the state. We'll have peace and freedom, independence and liberty. But that can't happen in the presence of an aggressive government, a government based on force and aggression and lies and theft. It can only happen when people realize, all of us, when we realize that aggression is not the answer. Aggression can never be the answer. And if a system is based on aggression, it's evil and it's wrong, and it should be rejected completely. Folks, thank you very much for listening today. Be sure and get to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission, and be sure and get over there today and follow that link for free stuff from Taryn Lupo. Be sure and take advantage of that. Thanks a lot, folks. Goodbye.